He turned his attention to the prow, where Clay had continued to perch himself, despite the weather. Through the squall, Aylmore caught occasional glimpses of Jack's scales, glittering in the fading light as he broke the surface. The younger Torkreek reported that the beast was unnerved by his new surroundings. Finding the relatively shallow waters and confines of the Torquils, a marked contrast to his vast home waters. However, his senses remained sharp, and so far the Blue hadn't detected any sign of another drake. Aylmore ordered the ship to 1/3 speed as evening slipped into night. The weather had stolen the stars from the sky, and he was unwilling to risk navigating by dead reckoning in such shallow waters. Running aground in peacetime was a career disaster for a captain, but in times like these, it would mean the end of this whole enterprise. Morning brought calmer waters, and an uninterrupted progress to the narrow channel that connected the lower Torquil to its northern twin. It was a notoriously dangerous strait that had the official name of Tormine's Cut, another feature named for one of the explorers who had first charted this region. In the habit of sailors, however, it had long since earned the name Terror's Cut, thanks to the number of ships that had fallen foul of its capricious nature. During a three-moon tide, it was said the waters of the Cut could reach heights equivalent to a tidal wave. Fortunately, they were in a relatively inactive lunar period, and the tides were unlikely to be high. Even so, Aylmore ordered the ship to dead slow as they approached the channel, partly to gauge the conditions, and also to allow the Farlight to catch up, the Blue Hunter having fallen behind during the night.
"Current appears to be flowing north, Captain,"
Talmont reported, having trained a spyglass on the Cut. Aylmore followed suit, tracking his own glass between the headland on either side of the channel. The terrain consisted of the kind of bare, sandy scrub typical to land regularly subjected to the three-moon tide, whilst the waters themselves seemed placid enough, though evidently fast-flowing. Aylmore checked to ensure the Farlight had closed to a few hundred yards, then ordered Talmont to signal the engine room.
"Ahead 1/3. Captain O'Canus to stand by to fire the Bloodburner if necessary."
"Aye, sir."
Aylmore turned his spyglass towards the prow, watching as Jack's spines twisted through the gentle swell towards the Cut. After a moment, the spines slipped below the surface as the beast swam ahead to scout their route.
"Mr. Steelfine,"
Aylmore said, causing the islander to snap to attention.
"Sir. Line and wait crew to the starboard beam. Best keep an eye on the depth. It's been a while since these waters were properly charted."
"I'll see to it, sir."
Steelfine saluted and left the bridge, voice carrying the length of the ship as he summoned a pair of crewmen. The draft had reduced to 50 feet by the time they entered the Cut, and then to 30 when the Superior reached the halfway point. The current was swift but manageable, Scrimshine managing to correct for its occasional shoves to the hull.
"Don't suppose you ever did any smuggling here, eh, Mr. Scrimshine?"
Aylmore inquired.
"Can't say I have, Skipper,"
he replied, turning the wheel 3 points to port to bring the prow back in line with the compass needle.
"No bugger around here to sell our wares to, see? Done plenty round Stockholm, though. Many a cozy inlet to be found on that coast."
"Sir!"
Talmont broke in, Aylmore raising his gaze to see Clay abruptly straightening at the prow. He turned and sprinted for the bridge, hands waving and shouting. Aylmore heard the word,
"Stop!"
through the bridge window.
"Is that another squall, sir?"
Talmont asked, training his glass on something beyond the prow. Aylmore followed his gaze, seeing the waters of the Cut some 200 yards ahead had begun to roil, as if stirred up by a sudden and vicious wind.
"He couldn't hear them,"
Clay said, appearing in the doorway, breathless and face hard with dire warning.
"They were hiding under the silt."
Aylmore turned back to view the roiling waters. He didn't need his spyglass to discern the cause. They were breaking the surface now, verdant scales glittering in the morning sun.
greens. Large aquatic greens. So many, they filled the entire breadth of Terrace Cut from end to end. Chapter 11. Lisanne. Estimated maximum altitude of 1,500 feet, Professor Lethbridge said. He strolled around the redesigned aerostat, arms clasped behind his back, and listing its virtues with the pride Lisanne couldn't recall being directed at her. Maximum speed of 40 miles an hour on kerosene, 83 under thermoplasmic power, a significant improvement in performance thanks to the information provided by you. He favored Lisanne with a rare smile. The aerodynamic refinements to the envelope alone added 20 miles an hour to the top speed, and another 10 thanks to the addition of an enclosed gondola. The new aerostat was indeed a more impressive specimen than its predecessor. The balloon itself had a more robust and elongated appearance, almost shark-like in the smooth curves achieved by Tinkerer's internal copper frame. The gondola was no longer just a small boat suspended by ropes from the balloon, but a narrow canoe-shaped capsule with glass windows in front and back, and hinged portholes in the side, which were wide enough to accommodate a carbine or mini growler if the need arose. The engine was suspended from the base of the gondola, on a sturdy steel frame that enabled it to be swiveled about by the pilot, facilitating a much greater range of control. Jemiah had wanted to add a second engine, but there simply weren't enough materials on board to construct it. Lisanne's gaze narrowed as it fell on the ugly bulk of the caloric burner. The way it sprouted through the roof of the gondola spoilt the craft's otherwise elegant lines. "A temporary but necessary modification," her father said, following her gaze. "With no helium or hydrogen on hand, it's the only means of achieving elevation." "I'm sure it will work perfectly, Father," she told him. She turned as Tekayla appeared at her side, clad in a heavy seaman's jacket, the sleeves of which had been trimmed to accommodate her less-than-regulation proportions. She carried a second jacket in her arms and wore a thick woolen hat on her head. Lisanne considered that she might have resembled a child playing dress-up, but for the shrewd appraisal she displayed in surveying the aerostat.
"No time for test flight, I suppose?"
she asked Jemiah.
"We don't have the fuel," he said, with a grimace of apology, before handing her a leather map case. "The course is marked and the compass heading already set. The captain advises that the winds tend to swing north over the red tides, so be sure to account for it."
Tekayla gave a tense nod, then hefted the second jacket into Lisanne's arms.
"It gets cold up there," she said, striding forward. "Shall we?"
Lisanne lingered a moment to exchange a few words with Macario, who had come along with Captain Trumaine to see them off. Tinkerer apparently felt no compulsion towards such social niceties, and was busy in the workshop improving Jemiah's mini-growler.
"Keep working on the solograph," Lisanne told the musician. "If you should happen to discover the final tune, don't play it for Tinkerer until I return."
He nodded, forcing a smile before nodding at the aerostat. Tekayla had already climbed the ladder into the gondola and started up the caloric burner with a loud whoosh, causing the craft to lift several inches off the aft deck.
"Room in there for a third party?"
Macario asked, and she was surprised to see he was serious.
"Who'll save your life when you get captured again?" he added. "I'll just have to manage," she said,
folding him into a brief embrace before turning to Captain Trumaine.
"A formal proposal," he said, holding out a sealed envelope. "I'm sure they'll find the terms generous enough to be tempting."
"Let's hope they also find them credible,"
Lisanne replied, taking the envelope. Trumaine gave one of his short but deep coughs, stiffening into a more formal posture.
"We shall proceed to a point 20 miles west of here," he said. "The waters off Feeman's Island, an uninhabited rock of little interest, but an easy locale to find. Also, pirates tend to avoid it. Some superstition about the place is being cursed by the King of the Deep. If my mission succeeds, I shall trance with Mrs. Griffin at the allotted hour, Lizanne told him. Please ask Dr. Waygrand not to sedate her too heavily.
And if you are unsuccessful?
Then it's doubtful a trance will be possible. I suggest you linger at Veman's Island no longer than 2 weeks. She paused, discomforted by the fact that she had no alternative destination to offer.
After 2 weeks, Tremaine said, we will have no option but to risk Corventine waters.
She nodded, wishing she had more to say, and that she felt this man to be more trustworthy. But once again the course of events had conspired to present her with nothing but bad choices. Best of luck, Captain, was all she could think to say. He gave a salute, the twitch that marred his features marginally less pronounced today.
And to you, miss.
Lizanne went to Jemiah, took the smoker and ammunition from him, before sharing a short, wordless embrace. She then moved to where her father was crouched beneath the gondola, engaged in a last-minute inspection of the engine. Any problems? She inquired. He didn't look up, gaze fixed on some component in the engine's internals. The plasma ignition valve can hold only one charge at a time, he said. The released energy will last for no more than 3 hours. It's ignited via a viewing tube in the gondola. I know, Father. It's very simple. She pulled on the jacket Takayla had given her, finding a woolen hat in one of the pockets. Professor Lethbridge remained crouched, working a screwdriver as he fixed an access panel in place. The feed tube to the condenser will freeze if the engine remains idle for too long at altitude. I know that too, Father. He tightened the last screw and finally raised his gaze to hers. She was shocked to find herself confronted by the pale, damp-eyed face of a very frightened man. Your aunt, he began in a strained voice, then faltered, looking away. Lizanne crouched at his side. Aunt Pendilla loved us both, and we loved her, she said. We were a family. She leaned forward and pressed a kiss to his temple. We still are. Best stand back, Father. It's time for me to leave. Takayla's small but nimble hands darted over the aerostat controls as the craft lifted off from the viable. She sat at the front of the gondola, with Lizanne in the rear, behind the central strut that connected the engine to the main body of the craft. Takayla used a large central lever fitted with a throttle to control the angle and speed of the engine. A smaller one to the left was connected to what her father had named ailerons, a pair of stubby wings protruding from either side of the gondola, which were used to control the forward and back pitch of the craft. A pair of foot levers directed the large rear rudder, which determined the port and starboard angle. Watching Takayla engage in the complex dance of lever and pedal that sent the aerostat into the air and on the correct heading, Lizanne wondered aloud if her musical training made her such a quick student as a pilot.
Possibly,
Takayla conceded, once they were clear of the ship. It was surprisingly quiet in the gondola. With the engine positioned outside, its whirring buzz was reduced to a low hum, allowing for easy conversation.
When I was little, Mother would stand over me with a ruler as I played my scales on the pianola. If I hit the wrong note, down came the ruler. It made for very quick hands.
If I'd ever met your mother, I'd have wrung the evil bitch's neck, Lizanne thought, but chose not to say. She glanced over her shoulder, seeing the rapidly diminishing outline of the viable through the rear window. As the aerostat drew higher still, the rest of the fleet came into view, dozens of ships all reduced to toy-like dimensions in the space of a few moments. Although no stranger to heights, Lizanne found that such a rapid ascent brought an uncomfortable lurch to the stomach
and a decided sense of disorientation. She turned away, occupying herself with checking their weapons. In addition to the smoker, they had the original mini-growler Jemiah had constructed in Pharos, plus a pair of pistols and a standard-issue Silworth rifle fitted with a telescopic sight. In Lazan's experience, it always paid to have a long-range weapon close at hand, a lesson starkly underlined by her experience in Skorazin.
"It has a tendency to veer upwards," Takayla said.
Lazan looked up from the mini-growler to see her eyes in the mirror above the forward window.
"Best keep it to short bursts."
Lazan saw a shadow creep into Takayla's eyes then, and she quickly lowered them to the controls.
"Heading is set," she said, finger tapping the compass. "Jemiah rigged a kind of pulley system that'll keep the levers at the right angle. Still have to correct for the wind, though, but it makes for a lighter workload."
"We still haven't spoken," Lazan said, "about what you saw in Pharos, about Cirrus." Lazan saw Takayla's slim shoulders tense beneath the bulky confines of her jacket.
"I wasn't making it up," she said.
"I know, but it does raise some troubling questions." She shifted forward, speaking softly.
"You said he saved you. How? The Greens..."
Takayla paused to swallow before continuing.
"The Greens burned their way in and Cirrus was there, standing in the wreckage of the workshop doors. He was spoiled, but I knew him right away. I tried to kill him. I had Jemiah's new gun and I tried to kill them all. I got all the Greens, but I ran out of bullets before I could get Cirrus. He just stood there looking at me. Then another spoiled came in, a woman. I didn't recognize her, but she seemed to know me, and not in a friendly way. She had a pistol. Cirrus shot her. I could tell it wasn't easy for him, but he did it. He did it to save me."
She fell silent for a while, tending to the controls with an occasional pause to wipe at her eyes.
"I wanted him to come with us. I asked him to, but he said he couldn't. He told us to go."
Lizanne reached around the central strut to grip the younger woman's shoulder, feeling her shudder as she contained a sob.
"He always loved you," she said. "I suppose."
Takayla gave a miserable sniff and wiped at her nose with the sleeve of her jacket.
"Though Emperor knows why. I was never exactly nice to him. All that awful poetry."
She drew in a hard breath, exhaling slowly.
"Still, I doubt he writes anything anymore."
"No, I don't expect he does. Takayla," Lizanne's grip grew slightly firmer on her shoulder.
"If he's spoiled, it means he's enthralled to the White, which means the White may possess every memory in his head. Every memory of you, me, the Solagraph, all of it. If it doesn't have it now, it may well soon."
"He saved me,"
Takayla insisted.
"He wouldn't betray us."
"Not willingly. I doubt any of the spoiled do what they do willingly, but they do it nonetheless. Savior or not, he's a threat to us, and I think he knows that. It's why he wouldn't go with you. Should we see him again?"
Takayla shifted, drawing her shoulder clear of Lizanne's grip.
"I won't do that,"
she stated, sitting straighter in her seat.
"And I don't want to talk about this anymore,"
she added, in a familiar but now rarely heard tone, rich in all the truculent stubbornness Lazan recalled from those first days in Morsvale.
"You might as well sleep,"
Takayla went on, shifting the main lever as the compass needle strayed a little from the heading.
"It'll be hours before we see anything but ocean."
The weather remained kind, and the aerostat made swift progress on its westward flight, aided by the wind for much of the way, until the first Forestian islands came into view a day and a half later. Takayla had managed barely 2 hours' sleep, slumping in her seat with one hand on the control lever and the engine set to its slowest speed. Nevertheless, she seemed fresh enough today. One of the advantages of youth, Lizanne supposed.
The captain wasn't wrong about the wind,
Takela commented, grunting a little as she hauled on the controls to keep the craft on the correct heading. Lizanne peered down at the small specks of land passing by below. These were the mostly uninhabited outer islands that formed the Sabirus Archipelago, a natural barrier on the eastern fringe of the Verestian region that served as an unofficial border between the Erethic Ocean and the Red Tides. From here on, the only ships to sail these waters were Verestian, either traders or pirates. Even before the Corventine Empire had been forced to forsake its sovereignty over the region, the Red Tides had mostly been shunned by both imperial and corporate ships. Despite a reputation as the finest and most wide-ranging mariners in the world, the Verestians had always been hostile to intruders into their own waters. Lizanne read through Captain Tremaine's letter once more. She had felt no compunction about breaking the seal, and was quite prepared to discard it should the contents prove counterproductive. In fact, she found the letter's diplomatic phrasing to be elegant and effective, containing nothing their potential hosts could take offense at, and striking the right balance between solicitation and conciliation. What would interest them most, she knew, was the offer of 10 million in syndicate scrip, or stock of equivalent value, in return for safe harbor, an offer far beyond Tremaine's authority to make. And far beyond mine, for that matter, she thought, folding the letter away. It was clear that in order to secure Verestian cooperation, she would have to engage in some spectacular lies. They saw their first Verestian vessel once they were over the larger islands, a dozen miles farther west. It was a large three-paddle freighter, easily identified by the broad wake it left on the ocean. Lizanne used the rifle scope to scan the ship. A flag she didn't recognize flew from the mast, making it an independent, as was the case with most Verestian ships. And pirates, she added inwardly. She doubted that this vessel was engaged in piracy, being too large for the kind of swift maneuvering required of that trade. It did, however, turn out to be armed. A flash appeared on the freighter's foredeck, followed a second or two later by the faint crump of a cannon shot. The gunners were clearly untrained in firing at aerial targets, because the shell was both wide and short, its fuse causing it to explode about 50 yards below and 100 yards behind the aerostat. Even so, it was close enough for Takela to open the throttle and increase the angle of the ailerons, taking them up to the craft's maximum ceiling in another gut-disturbing lurch.
"Could you warn me when you're going to do that?" Lizanne requested. "Sorry."
Takela glanced out of the starboard porthole at the ship below.
"That wasn't very friendly, was it?"
"No."
Lizanne saw several more flashes flaring on the freighter's deck as it brought all its guns into play, though none of the shells it launched came any closer than the first.
"They have no idea who we are," she went on,
as the cluster of small black clouds left by the exploding shells drifted away and the freighter shrank into the distance.
"Or any notion what this craft is. Troubled times makes for nervous hands. And when we get to the Seven Walls?"
Lizanne turned to Takela, finding her doll's face tense with worry.
"Easy to forget how young she is sometimes," Lizanne chided herself.
She resisted the impulse to lie, offer some bland reassurance. But a cooperative mission required trust between agents.
"I don't know," she said. "They may fire on us as soon as they see us, or they may not. They may allow us to land and immediately arrest us."
Takela nodded, small worry lines creasing her forehead.
"Or worse," she said. "Yes, or worse."
She gestured at the small clock Jemiah had set amongst the cluster of dials in front of the pilot station.
"How much longer?"
Takela straightened and turned, taking a firmer grip on the control lever.
"In this wind, at least another 10 hours." Which means we'll be arriving in darkness. I can circle through the night, begin the approach at dawn. No, you'll be too fatigued.
Lizanne rose into a crouch and shuffled forward to the viewing tube that sat alongside the central strut.
Time to fire up the blood burner, I think. The professor said it has only one charge, and once started, the only way to stop it is to flush the plasma from the combustion chamber. It might be better to save it for emergencies. We can recharge it when we land, assuming we're allowed to take off again. If not, then it won't matter.
She flipped open the cover on the viewing tube and put her eye to the socket.
Besides, I should like to see just how fast this thing can go. Ready? 1 second. Need to level the ailerons, otherwise the slipstream will tear them off.
Lizanne heard a snick as Takayla locked one of the levers into place.
Ready.
Lizanne took her wallet from the pocket of her jacket and extracted a vial of red, taking a small sip before returning her eye to the viewing tube. Her father had placed a little luminescent disc inside the plasma valve, so it was easy to make out the small pool of viscous liquid it held. A brief flare of red, and the product immediately burst into an eye-wateringly bright fireball. She was about to opine that adding tinted glass to the eyepiece might be a good idea, when the aerostat surged forward with enough force to send her sprawling. She heard Takayla let out a startled but delighted giggle and blinked the moisture from her eyes to see that she now had both hands on the control lever. Over her shoulder, Lizanne could see the needle on the speedometer swiftly ascending to its maximum reading, where it stayed.
Must be over 100 miles an hour at least,
Takayla said with an appreciative laugh.
Looks as if the professor underestimated his invention. Co-invention.
Lizanne corrected, glancing through a porthole to see the wispy cloud beyond passing by at a greatly accelerated rate.
When we get back to the ship, remind me to draft a proper patent and a contract to cover distribution of future profits.
They cleared the Cerberus archipelago in what seemed like minutes, bringing them into the red tides proper. They were low enough to make out the waves passing below, the ocean surface blurring thanks to their speed. Several more ships came into view, most much smaller than the freighter, though none felt the need to fire on them. Lizanne suspected this was due more to their increased speed than any lack of hostility. In all, it took just under 4 hours before Takayla reported land in sight. The thermoplasmic engine had exhausted its supply by then, forcing Takayla to combat the winds once more, though she proved adept at keeping the approaching landmass firmly in the center of the forward window. Lizanne moved forward, leaning over to Kayla's shoulder to view the landscape, her eyes tracking over the coast in search of landmarks.
"Is Khmer," she said, spying a broad inlet a few degrees to the north.
She gave to Kayla's shoulder a grateful squeeze.
"We're in the right place. You better take us up high as you can, please. No telling what reception we'll get from the locals."
The island of Iskemir was often referred to in atlases and almanacs as the jewel or beating heart of Verestia, the central hub where pirates came to sell their booty and traders to buy it. As they flew over the eastern coast, Lizanne was struck by how many ports it featured, all surrounded by towns of varying proportions. It occurred to her that this might well be the most densely populated landmass on the globe, meaning the place had to be reliant on imported cargo to feed its population, as the interior was mostly mountains or rough hill country.
"Not a place to hold out for very long in a siege," she concluded, as the aerostat drew away from the coast and into the mountains.
The peaks were so tall, Takayla had to slow the craft and steer away through them, falling on the controls with ever more energy, thanks to the fractious air currents and drifting patches of mist.
"Best if we fly around this place on the way back," she said,
the labor having left a sheen of sweat on her face despite the chill. Once through the mountains, they flew across a thin stretch of cultivated fields, before once again finding themselves over the sea, as they reached the strait that separated Iskemir from the unique construction that formed the Seven Walls. It came into view quickly, at first appearing to be a dark, strangely regular notch on the horizon, but soon grew to a size that put her in mind of the mountains they had just traversed. She knew the great fortress's origin dated back at least 1,000 years, and was a truly ingenious design. A small central island complete with a port, around which a series of seven walls had been constructed between the smaller outlying islets. The result was a self-contained port, permanently shielded from the tide on all sides. However, during the days when the old Forestian League had fought the last of its wars against the encroaching Corventine Empire, it had been greatly enlarged. The walls now stood over 100 feet high, featuring a miniature fort at each intersection. Once again making use of the rifle scope, Bazan could see each fort bristling with guns and busy with ant-sized figures running to their stations. It appeared their approach had not gone unnoticed. Within the walls lay the port itself, so crammed with buildings, wharfs and jetties, Bazan could see scant sign of vegetation, save for the occasional tree. "I hope they've been stockpiling food," she mused. The only open space was a central square, surrounded by a series of grand buildings, the largest of which she assumed would house the Verestian's quasi-government.
"We'll land there," Lizanne said, pointing to the square. "The forts?" Tekela asked in a thin voice.
They were close enough now to see the gun crews loading their pieces.
"Let's hope they have enough honor to observe traditional customs."
Lizanne went to the canvas bag she had obtained from Captain Trumaine. The item it contained was large and unwieldy, taking several tiresome minutes to extract. When it was done, she dragged it to the hatch in the gondola's floor.
"Hover in place for a moment," she told Tekela. "We need to make sure they see it."
She opened the hatch as Tekela duly brought the craft to a slow sideways drift, then fastened the ties attached to the corners of the item to the main strut before pushing it out. The flag unfurled to its full length, thanks to the stiff winds found at these heights, revealing a design Lizanne hoped would still be recognized in these uncertain times. A white circle on a red background. Even the Verestians were reputed to respect the universal signal requesting truce and negotiation. They drifted for several minutes as the flag fluttered and flapped below the aerostat. Bazan kept careful watch on the closest fort, detecting a certain amount of confusion amongst the gun crews, and no small amount of accompanying argument. She even saw a couple of men come to blows, but no cannon were fired.
"Take us in," she told Tekela. "A slow and gentle approach would be best."
She was obliged to cut the flag free once they were over the wall, as it was coming perilously close to fouling the engine's propellers. They would just have to hope the Verestians didn't take this as a signal of hostile intent. People thronged the wharfs and streets as they flew over the port towards the square, most staring in wonder or suspicion, a few running in panic. There were numerous ships at anchor, and many began to make steam at the sight of the aerostat. None of this gave Lizanne much confidence in a safe landing, but they couldn't turn back now. Tekela guided the aerostat to a hover when they came to the square, then slowly reduced the heat of the caloric burner to ensure a gentle congress with the ground. One of Jemiah's design additions to the aerostat was retractable landing gear that sprouted from the gondola's underside and rather resembled a metallic eagle's claw. Tekela deployed it when they were a few feet from the square's paved surface, and the aerostat settled down with only a small bump.
"Excellently done," Lizanne complimented her, peering through the window at a group of men rapidly descending the steps of the large building to their front.
There were about 20 of them, and each one bore a rifle or carbine.
"You had better go out and greet our hosts."
Tekela gaped at her.
"Me?"
Lizanne went to the rear of the gondola and began assembling the required equipment.
"I'll be along directly," she said,
strapping on her spider.
What do I say to them?
Hello is traditional.
I don't speak Verestian.
Don't worry, they're almost always multilingual.
Takela hesitated for a long, silent moment, then undid the forward hatch and climbed out of the gondola. Bazan heard the pounding of boots as the men drew near and fanned out, one of them demanding something in harsh, breathless Verestian. Takela said.
Hello.
There was a short pause, during which Lazan used the spider to inject a small burst of green before moving to the rear hatch.
Who the fuck are you?
The same voice demanded in heavily accented Mandanorian.
And what the fuck is this?
My name is Burgravine Takela Artonin,
came the response in admirably steady tones.
And I don't see any need for profanity, sir.
Trust me, girl,
the voice went on, growing louder as its owner drew closer.
A foul tongue is the least of...
His words were drowned out as Lazan stepped out from under the gondola, raised the mini growler, and let loose with a prolonged burst of fire. She found Takela was right about the weapon's tendency to pull up when fired. It was also somewhat unwieldy, thanks to the ammunition load and the miniature caloric engine required to spin the barrels. Consequently, even with the benefit of green, Zan's aim was not as precise as she would have liked. The mini growler stitched a vertical line of bullet holes up the edifice of the largest building in the square, before transforming one of the statues on its roof into a stump of shattered marble. Lazan removed her finger from the firing mechanism, lowering her gaze to find that the men who had come to greet them were all now lying face down on the paving stones. She strode forward, focusing her gaze on the upturned face of the man who had addressed Takela. In normal circumstances, he would probably have been an imposing fellow, with his weathered face and saber-scarred cheeks. Now he was just another scared man facing death. It was an expression she had grown used to recently.
I shall explain your choices in very simple terms, she said. You can get up, apologize to my friend for your language, and take us to see the Verestian Ruling Council. Or,
she aimed the mini growler's smoking barrels directly at his head,
I'll kill you and every man here, then go and find them myself.
Chapter 12. Clay.
Battle stations! Riflemen, assemble on deck!
Hylmore's orders rang out from the bridge as Clay turned and slid down the ladder, making for his position on the prow. The superior's forward pivot gun fired before he could get there. The shot aimed low, so that it impacted in the center of the approaching mass of greens in a spout of white and red. Clay went to the port rail instead, pistol drawn as he stared down at the water below.
Jack!
He could feel the blue's distress, an instinctive fear of greater numbers overcoming his loyalty. A brief sharing of minds revealed him to be circling frantically beneath the superior's stern, attempting to conceal himself in the silt his coils raised from the seabed.
Old Jack was never as mighty as last look, Clay reminded himself, nor so crazy.
He heard another shouted command from the bridge, and saw Steelfine marshalling his riflemen. The Islander sent a squad of six to the port rail, and the remaining seven to starboard. Several more riflemen appeared on the upper works, accompanied by Sigurold and Loriabeth. A glance above revealed Preacher's tall form scaling the ladder to the crow's nest, his rifle slung across his back. Clay couldn't see his uncle or Skaggerhill, but knew they would be taking up stations somewhere in the aft section. The forward gun fired again, quickly followed by both the port and starboard cannon, meaning the greens were all around them now. Clay returned his gaze to the sea, at first seeing nothing but the roiling wake rebounding from the hull, then reeling back as a green launched itself out of the water, mouth gaping. The heat of the Drake's fire was fierce enough to stun him, sending him sprawling onto the deck, smoke rising from his singed clothing. He scrabbled to extinguish the flames clinging to his sleeves, then, realizing he had dropped his revolver, reached for the wallet of product in his jacket. He had managed to get it open when a loud hiss dragged his gaze to the rail, in time to see the green clambering onto the deck. Like most aquatic greens, it was considerably larger and longer of body than its land-based cousins, the head and snout narrow and spear-like, and possessed of a barbed, whip-like tail. Seeing the beast coil its tail for a strike, Clay rolled on the deck an instant before the thorny tip slammed into the boards with splintering force. Clay's mind filled with feverish curses as he fumbled for his vials, desperately trying to get one to his lips. The green, however, saw no reason to allow him the luxury of time and lunged, jaws snapping, then fell dead as a bullet tore through its skull. Clay gaped at the bleeding, twitching body of the green, then felt hands grip him beneath the shoulders, trying to drag him upright.
"Are you hurt?"
Chris asked, once he was on his feet. She had obtained a revolver from somewhere, and stood with her back to him, aiming at the multiple greens now boiling over the superior's rails. Rifle fire crackled continually, punctuated by more rapid pistol and carbine shots, and the hissing roar of drake flames. A scream snapped Clay's gaze to the forward gun crew. They had abandoned the pivot gun, and were attempting to fend off a trio of greens with sea axes and boat hooks. One gunner was already down, yelping as he beat at the flames consuming his legs. Clay took three vials from his wallet, green, red, and black, put all three to his lips, and drank half the contents.
"Take all of it,"
he said, handing the vials to Chris, before crouching to retrieve his pistol and starting forward.
"I'll do the killing. Keep them off me."
He froze one green in place as it darted towards the burning crewman, shooting it in the head, then stunned the other two with a mixed blast of red and black. They skittered back, hissing in distress and rage. He used his green-enhanced reflexes to shoot one through the eye, but the other was too quick, swiftly dodging to the side, then lashing out with its tail to spear one of the gunners through the chest. Chris shouted an enraged expletive in her own language, casting out an inexpert but effective wave of black that pinned the green to the side rail long enough for Clay to put a bullet through its head. The burnt man lay writhing in agony as the two remaining gunners used a jacket to quench the last of the flames, but Clay could tell the fellow wouldn't last long. A quick look around confirmed the foredeck and the prow free of greens, but the middeck and the upper works were thick with the beasts. Dozens had been killed, and dozens more continued to fall to the crew's desperate fusillade, but ever more were boiling out of the sea to clamber up the hull.
"You got canister?"
Clay asked one of the gunners, who could only stare at him in shock, until Clay grabbed his jacket and shook him.
"Canister! You got any?"
"Just three shells,"
the man said, moving to the recessed compartment in the deck where the ammunition was stored.
"The Corvies used most of it up at the strait."
"Get it loaded," Clay said. "We'll keep them back."
The gunners got to work whilst Clay and Chris positioned themselves to the rear of the gun, dispatching any green that detached itself from the main pack to charge them. Chris seemed to be learning with every use of product, the blasts of red and black becoming more accurate. Clay saw her snap the forelegs of one green, then roast its eyes as it stumbled to a halt a few yards away.
"Neat trick,"
he said, finishing the green with a bullet to the skull, his last bullet.
"You ready yet?"
he demanded, turning back to the gun.
"Ready,"
one of the gunners said, snapping the breech closed before he and his comrade began swiveling the gun about.
"Better get behind us if you don't want to be shredded."
Clay and Chris moved swiftly to comply, as the gunners brought the pivot gun to bear on the upper works.
"Where do we aim?"
one asked.
"Starboard side,"
Clay said, pointing.
"That's where they're thickest."
"Guard your ears,"
the other gunner said, reaching for the firing lanyard. Clay clamped his hands over the side of his head, nodding for Chris to do the same. Even so, The gun's blast was enough to leave a ringing in his ears and cause an involuntary closing of the eyes. When he looked again, the mass of drakes assailing the starboard flank of the upper works had been transformed into a green and red morass. Eviscerated and part dismembered greens lay about the ladders and walkways, some still twitching. Amongst it all, they could see the dark uniform of a protectorate sailor.
"Port side,"
he said, forcing his gaze away.
"Hurry up!"
They had to fend off another charge before the gun was ready to fire again, Clay feeling his reserves of product diminish with every slaughtered drake. Fortunately, Preacher had evidently seen their plight and chose to lend a hand. Three greens went down in quick succession, felled by long rifle shots from the crow's nest. Despite this, the greens continued to come for them, and by the time the gunners called out a warning, their product was almost all spent. There was no time to retreat, so he and Chris threw themselves flat, hands covering their ears as the gun blasted out its hail of iron balls. The effect of this shot was even more deadly than the first, sweeping most of the attacking greens away in an instant, leaving behind a dozen or so thrashing wounded. Clay scanned the midships, seeing no sign of any more greens clambering out of the sea. A cacophony of shots and shouts could be heard from the stern, indicating this fight wasn't over yet.
"Come on," he told Chris, running for a ladder. "I expect the captain's got some more product." "Your pet is a coward."
Steelfine glared at Clay, tattooed features hard with accusation beneath a mask of blood. A drake claw had left a trio of parallel cuts on the crown of his shaven head, though any pain he might have felt seemed to have been subsumed by anger.
8 good men dead and 6 grievously burned or gashed, whilst that monster skulks below."
They were on the aft deck, where Lieutenant Talmont had charge of the cleanup crew. They were all clad in oilskins to protect against the effects of so much drake blood, and used brooms to push the green bodies, most of them in pieces, over the side. The more intact ones had been piled near the hold for harvesting later. The fighting had been fiercest here. Having been forced back from the rails, Steelfine's riflemen had taken up a defensive position near the stern, consequently suffering the brunt of the casualties. Once the pivot gun's canister had cleared the upper works, Halmore and Lieutenant Sigarol, fortified by product from the ship safe, had led the counterattack to clear the rear of the ship. But not before the majority of the islanders' squad had been killed or wounded.
"He ain't a pet,"
Clay replied, keeping his voice as passive as he could. This wasn't a time to surrender to provocation.
"He's a creature from another age trapped in a body that ain't his, and he don't even understand what a coward is. He's just trying to survive." "So he survives whilst my men die."
Steelfine took a step closer, a murderous glint in his eye.
"That doesn't seem a fair exchange to me."
"Number one,"
Aylmore said. His voice was soft but commanding enough to bring Steelfine to immediate attention.
"Sir."
"You're wounded. Report to sickbay for treatment."
Steelfine didn't move for a moment, continuing to stare at Clay with jaw clenched until he snapped off a salute, grated,
"Aye, sir,"
between clenched teeth, and marched away.
"At least now our green stocks should hold out for a while,"
Aylmore commented, clasping his arms behind his back as he surveyed the blood-drenched deck.
"I'll set Mr. Skaggerhill to it when he's finished in the sick bay."
He paused to regard one particular corpse, a drake that had been caught by canister shot. Its lower body had been disintegrated, whilst its upper half hung from a walkway, the creature's jaw fixed on an overhead beam with such force none of the crewmen had yet managed to dislodge it.
"It was well done, Mr. Torkreek," Aylmore said. "The canister. An excellent notion."
Clay forced a half-grin.
"Just trying to survive, too, Captain."
"You might have made a fine protectorate officer had things been different."
"That don't seem likely,"
but thank you anyways.
Those were your uncle's doing.
Aylmore gestured at a cluster of green corpses, arranged in a rough semicircle around the starboard gun emplacement.
I saw him step up onto the gun just as it all started.
Just kept loading and firing throughout the whole engagement. I don't think he missed once.
Uncle Braddon's always been one of the finest marksmen on the continent.
It's not his marksmanship that concerns me. It's his demeanor, or rather his lack of it. He killed all of these and didn't once change his expression, nor did he show any sign of seeking a safer vantage point.
He's not quite himself just now. You know why.
Grief can lead a man to madness if it's stoked by vengeance. I'm wondering if instead of leaving one captain behind on your expedition, it might be better to leave two.
No.
Clay gave an adamant shake of his head.
Mad with grief or not, we wouldn't last more than a few days in the interior without him.
We have all suffered much on this strange voyage of ours, Aylmore replied. Lost many lives, men who trusted my judgment enough to follow me to the end of the world and back. I would not have that sacrifice be in vain. See this mission imperiled.
Captain!
Aylmore turned at Lieutenant Talmont's urgent call. The young officer stood at the stern, pointing at the firelight, which had previously been anchored some 100 yards off, but was now making steam and drawing away. The Blue Hunter had been completely unscathed by the green assault, seemingly ignored by the Drakes, who focused their fury entirely on the Superior. However, it appeared her crew had finally seen enough.
Getting too hot around here!
Talmont translated the flickering signal lamp on the Firelight's bridge house.
Crew won't stand it. Making for Stockholm. Best of luck and apologies, Tidlow.
Seems your islanders got more cowards to rant about, Clay observed.
Yes, Aylmore agreed. Captain Tidlow would do well to avoid him in future.
He gave Clay a critical glance.
Are you sure about your uncle?
The one man in this world I'll always be sure of is my uncle.
Very well. But make no mistake, Mr. Torkreek. Whether you know it or not, or like it or not, the expedition to Crystalline Lake will be under your command. Your Uncle Braddon has forsaken such duty. I see it if you do not.
They cleared Terra's Cut the following morning, Aylmore having ordered the blood burner brought online to ensure a swift passage. They were aided by the tide, which raised the waters of the cut into a fast-moving swell, propelling them clear of the channel without the risk of running aground on an uncharted sandbank. Fortunately, no more greens appeared come daylight, and they made an unmolested progress into the upper Torquil, covering much of the distance to the mouth of the Quillam River before nightfall. The Superior spent a nervous night at full alert, riflemen and lookouts posted in double shifts, and all guns manned and loaded. For now at least, it seemed the aquatic greens were content to leave them be.
You sure this thing will work? Clay asked Chris the next morning as he helped her carry her bulky breathing apparatus to the steam launch.
I think so, and so does Chief Bosware, she replied. I would have liked to conduct a proper test, but...
She glanced around at the becalmed misty waters surrounding their anchorage. The upper Torquil had so far proven to be less fractious than the lower. In slight winds, the surface took on an almost glass-like aspect, which somehow made it more ominous, as it betrayed no sign of what might lie beneath.
Yeah,
Clay agreed, grunting as they heaved the apparatus into the launch.
Best to wait till we get to the lake.
He left her to check the device's various valves and tubes, joining Lauriabeth and Sigurol at the rail, where they were engaged in a typically acerbic discussion.
Just take it off,
his cousin told the Corventine, reaching out to pluck at his eye patch.
Can't keep it on forever.
Still hurts,
he said in a sullen mutter, snatching his head away.
There was a tension to his bearing that told Clay his reluctance to remove the patch had little to do with any pain it might cause.
Lori, he said, Skaggs needs help hauling up the rest of the ammo.
She seemed about to tell him to do it himself, but paused on seeing his insistent frown.
Your men think you're weird for still wearing it,
she informed Sigurol before making for the hold. If I recall correctly, Clay said, moving to Sigurol's side, you favor the right eye when shooting. How are you with the left? Sigurol gave a chagrined grimace.
When the Drakes attacked, I must have fired 50 rounds. I think I managed 6 hits, all at close range.
You'll do better over time. Just takes practice. He fished inside his duster and came out with a wallet. Compliments of the captain, he said, handing it over. Full vials of all 4 colors. I had a short trance with Captain O'Canis this morning. Be obliged if you did the same. Sigurol nodded, consigning the wallet to his jacket pocket.
How's her mind?
Surprisingly neat and pretty. It's a ship, as you might expect, but made of jewels. Each jewel is a memory. You?
The cliffs on Takmarin's land. I spent many hours there as a boy. The Kada agent who tutored me said it was best to choose something familiar.
Sigurol fell silent, looking to the broad river mouth half a mile to the north.
You have traveled the Eratian interior before, he said. Is it as bad as they say?
No, Clay replied. And yes. A lot depends on your manner of travel. I knew a woman who spent near 20 years out there and never got a scratch, though she did have a good deal of help. He gave Sigurol a sidelong glance, seeing the mottled flesh poking out from the edges of his eye patch. My cousin really don't care about scars and such, he said. Just so you know. Sigurol lowered his gaze, saying nothing. Clay slapped his hands to the rail and moved away.
Captain Heilmore says the ship will only manage a few hours' travel up the river before they have to drop us off, he said. Be sure to do your trancing before then.
They were a good 5 miles into the river mouth before it began to narrow. Banks thick with tall reeds closing in on both sides, and drawing closer the farther north they steamed. The previously calm waters became churned with wayward currents and dark with disturbed silt. Clay stood at the stern, watching Jack's spines cut the surface as he followed the ship. The Drake could sense the imminence of their separation, and didn't like it, his fearful thoughts accompanied by a plaintive call that thrummed the deck beneath Clay's feet.
You can't go where I'm going, Clay told him once again,
a mantra he had been obliged to repeat for the last few hours.
But I'll still be with you.
Jack seemed to take only marginal reassurance from this, his confusion having deepened ever since the Greens attacked the ship. He had never encountered their kind before, and his thoughts were tinged with a wary repugnance that could be articulated as, smell wrong, sound wrong.
That they do, Clay conceded.
And if they come back, you may have to fight them. Jack's thoughts grew warier still, an instinctive desire to avoid danger conflicting with his need to maintain their connection. Clay wondered if it might be kinder to set the beast free, as he had with Lutheron before they set off for the ice. But they still had so much to do, and who knew what use he might be in the future? I really ain't a very nice person, he reflected, causing Jack to voice a puzzled rumble, this one thrumming the ship with sufficient force to make the rail buzz in Clay's hands.
Awful big ocean out there, Clay reminded him. You ain't my slave, Jack. You want to go, then go.
Jack's head rose out of the water for a moment, twin jets of flame sprouting from his nostrils as he gave what could only be called a derisive snort. His snout dipped back below the surface, but his eyes remained visible, Clay sensing a certain reproach in the stare Jack leveled at him.
Guess that settles it,
he conceded. Once I'm gone, the ship will return to the Torquils to wait for us. Stay close if you can.